afternoon. I'm glad you're here to hear our third case for the day, 11AP 329 FT Michael J. Waldvogel Trucking versus Labor and Industry Review Commission. Arguing for Michael J. Waldvogel Trucking is John Rohde. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon to the court, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and fellow justices of the Supreme Court and opposing counsel. My name is John Rohde, and I represent the respondent petitioner, according to the caption of this case, Michael J. Waldvogel Trucking, LLC. I hope that it pleases the court that the issue upon which this court has granted review presents the court with a wonderful opportunity to further develop and clarify Wisconsin unemployment law. Specifically, that issue upon which this court has accepted review is, can an employee who uses illegal drugs, thus making himself ineligible for employment, receive unemployment benefits? The court's decision on that issue is both necessary and important because I believe there exists in the Wisconsin law right now a conundrum or a dilemma that can be solved by the court's decision on this case. Specifically, that dilemma is, on the one hand, we have the rule of law that is my opponent's primary basis for his argument, the A.O. Smith case that sets forth what I call the indefinite layoff rule, wherein the Supreme Court has held that a person who is on an indefinite period of layoff is not considered to be in an employment relationship. And Lurk, in this case, I hope you don't mind me referring to them as Lurk, it'll be shorter, extrapolates from that rule that, therefore, no misconduct that occurs during a period of indefinite layoff can be deemed misconduct connected with employment. Now, where does the dilemma arise? Well, it arises where we have misconduct, such as we do in this particular case, illegal drug use, that destroys a person's eligibility to return to the job from which they are on an indefinite layoff period. It is our position that all misconduct that destroys eligibility to return to a job must be deemed misconduct connected with employment, even if it is done during a period of indefinite layoff.
So, counsel, what would you have us do with that language? No employment relationship exists following layoff for an indefinite period. Overrule it, change it, modify it. What do you do with that?
I think make a corollary or an exception to the rule. And that's a very good question, Justice Ziegler. And I get a little flustered because I'll get off my script here. But, yes, basically what I'm...
It's beginning.
I know. Basically, what I'm asking for is a corollary to the rule. I was going to state that really we don't have a problem with the general, what I call the indefinite layoff rule, but there must be an exception for the rule when the misconduct that we're dealing with actually destroys the eligibility to return to the particular job from which the person is laid off. And again, I believe that is the dilemma. What I'd like to start, take
before
the court.
Before you do that.
Yes.
Lurk's brief indicates the 2011 WIS Act 32 takes care of this case. Does it?
Yes and no. It would take care of this case from this point forward, and I'll go out of order. I have some points that I'd like to make on that question, Justice Abrahamson. Yes, as my opponent has correctly pointed out, and I agree with his position, that 2011 Wisconsin Act 32 does, in fact, create a new law, 108.04 sub 8 sub B, which did not exist prior to the summer of 2011, which now disqualifies benefit applicants from eligibility for unemployment when they are deemed to have failed to accept an offer of work after their employers basically withdraw an offer of work due to a failed drug test. As my opponent correctly points out in his brief, that law is prospective because it is procedure or it is substantive and not procedural.
The reason I ask you the question is that if prospectively the legislature has taken care of it, then your case is very important for your client, and I understand that. But what effect does it have for the future, and how many of your clients are still in the pipeline?
I agree. It's vitally important to my client because he does not reap the benefit of the change due to the fact
that this case... I understand that, but this court might or might not have taken the case if at that time the statute had changed.
My comment to that, and I was just reminded of this recently in an entirely different context on some research I was doing on a different case, I still believe it is vitally important for the common law to be consistent with and even complementary to new statutes, because the issue I got tripped up on, and I won't belabor the specifics because it's irrelevant, but I was reading a case which was still good law. It had not been overturned, and we don't shepherdize anymore, but when I looked at the yellow flag that came up on Westlaw, yeah, it didn't even reference a statute, but I got the issue wrong, and I was embarrassed with my senior partner because he said, well, what about this statute? And I said, oh, my gosh, you're correct. There is a statute that really supplants it now. So I think it's important for Justice Abrahamson, for the Chief Justice Abrahamson, for the legislature and the case law or the common law to be consistent with and complement each other. And that's why I still think it is necessary for the court to issue a ruling that I hope is consistent with that new statute.
We could just issue a ruling that says this case is no longer totally valid, or this case has been superseded by the statute. That would solve that your little problem about
that would solve the problem. If you gave a decision that simple, that would again, yes, solve the problem for all people probably forward from this point. Unfortunately, it would leave my client.
But you want review here, but this is resolved for a similar case in the future.
I believe that the new statute does resolve it, but I still believe that a decision is warranted that complements mm-hmm. or is consistent with that. Let me just back up for a moment to I really wanted to cite this case, and I just reread it. I got here so early this morning. I was in the reading room and reread it. It's a 1951 decision, and I think the Chief Justice might appreciate it because although it's a decision from this court, it cites an Indiana decision, and it is the Western Printing case cited in my brief, and I think it's important to go back and just examine the very purpose of unemployment compensation in the first place, and that Western Printing case says, I think so succinctly and simply, that the purpose of unemployment compensation is for the relief of those unemployed through no fault of their own. I think that's really a key phrase, and we have to remember that's the background for this. And keeping that in mind and applying it to modern and current law, I think there are two bases. They're argued in my brief, the 108.04 sub 5 bases, the misconduct theory, and the other bases for our position is 108.04 sub 1, sub B, sub 1, and sub 2, which are the statutes that deal with availability to work and ability to work. And I can address each of those in turn. With regard to misconduct first, 108.04 sub 5, I won't belabor it too long, but I'll just read one sentence from the statute. It says that an employee whose work is terminated by an employing unit for misconduct connected with the employee's work is ineligible to receive benefits. Of course, misconduct, we are lucky the Supreme Court of this state in 1941 issued the seminal decision that's cited throughout the United States of America on the meaning of misconduct in an employment unemployment status, and that is the Boynton-Cabb decision, where the court described misconduct as an intentional and substantial disregard of the employer's interests or of the employee's duties and obligations to his employer. And I would note that Judge Kowalski, my home judge in Langlade County, who heard this case on judicial review, picked up on that theme from the Boynton decision, and when he ruled in favor of the trucking company that maintaining a valid CDL not only bears a reasonable relationship to the employer's interest, but is at the very heart of such interest.
Well, isn't it the point here, or a point, that the employee here is,
Mr. Berceau,
is on indefinite leave. Mm-hmm. And the case law says if you're on indefinite leave, you're no longer in an employment relationship. Okay. So he's not in an employment relationship, and in this case, he apparently does an illegal act, right? But he's not an employee, right?
Right.
So you have to be saying that to apply Boynton Cab here, he intentionally and substantially disregarded his employer's interest. Well, he doesn't have an employer when he takes the marijuana. And that, the cases seem to say, the LURC seems to say, he's not employed. He therefore does things before he's employed, and that conduct before he's employed can't be intentional and substantial disregard of the employer's interest because he's not employed. Now, you got a different question regarding his ability to keep his license, but that's another question. So what do you say about that?
I don't think it's that simple because really he's
nothing ever is, right?
If it were, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
If it were that simple, he's not just either he's an employee or he's not. This employee, Mr. Berceau, is really in a unique category. He is a person on an indefinite layoff with the chance of being recalled to his old position that he had. And it is because he was a former employee that he is even possibly eligible for unemployment benefits.
So your position is that if you've been employed for this employer and you're out of employment, but if you want to get back in, and you don't know you will, you don't know you won't, you have to abide by that employer's work rules for this. Could it be a month? It could be 2 months. It could be 3 years.
Maybe not all of their work rules, Chief Justice Abrahamson, but certainly the basic rules that would destroy your eligibility to potentially return to work for that employer, I think you would still be subject to those. I cited two, I was racking my brain for some examples of different situations that could come up, and again, forgive me, I'm sure you've all read my brief with great interest, but I came up with the example of suppose a teacher, this is a current issue in our state right now, school districts struggling with their budgets. If they have a teacher that they have to lay off, and suppose that teacher were to strike up an inappropriate relationship with, say, a 17-year-old student and be caught, certainly they are going to lose their teaching credential or license. But if you strictly apply the indefinite layoff rule, even though now they've lost their license to teach, they can't have that held against them, and they would be entitled to unemployment benefits if the school district wanted to reemploy them and then found out, oh, whoops, no, I guess we can't. You've destroyed your eligibility, but you still get unemployment.
That goes to the second issue of licensing. Suppose the teacher uses his or her own computer at home and watches child pornography, which would certainly be condemned if it was done at the school during school hours.
Mm-hmm.
Where's your position on that?
Well,
they wouldn't lose their license, right? That's personal.
Well, I don't know if they would lose their license or not. If it rose to the level of crime, they may.
Well, let's assume it didn't, and it's personal, and it doesn't even have to be child pornography, any pornography, okay?
Right. I think there is certainly some misdeeds that we would agree that would not qualify as totally overriding the indefinite layoff rule. And I think we've argued that in the brief. But again, the difference is the misdeeds that actually destroy the eligibility to come back to the job. That's the new category I'm advocating for, that there must be an exception for.
Well, counsel, my attention is drawn to the Kremp case, Kremp versus LURC. And in that, it discusses a concept of blocking a job offer. How does that concept relate to what you're arguing for in terms of an exception to the A.O. Smith, or is that a separate and distinct analysis?
Yep. Justice Gableman, blocking is a separate category. It is discussed in my brief. I do cite and rely upon the Crump case. I think it's applicable. The statutory basis for blocking, I believe, is 108.04 sub 8 sub A, from which then this new statute last summer kind of sprang as a offshoot of that. But that is basically the statute that says blocking employment is considering a failure to accept a job offer, which then destroys eligibility. And that's what happened in the Kremp decision. The reason I believe Kremp, though, is particularly applicable to this case, my opponent wants to distinguish Kremp by saying, well, in that particular case, what the person did was they were recalled to work. And then after they were recalled, the night before, they went and really tied one on and drank a whole bunch of alcohol and showed up for the drug test, and they suspected the person was drunk, tested them, confirmed they were drunk, and then said, oh, you've gone out and done something after you were recalled to block your own employment. And my opponent makes a big issue out of the fact that it was done after. I would submit, though, that that's particularly egregious when you do it after you were told you were recalled. But any activity that blocks your own eligibility to return to the job, especially when you know in advance, as Mr. Burso did, or people who drive truck, that, hey, if I get recalled, I know I'm going to have to take a drug test. So even though I may or may not be recalled, if I use drugs, I'm going to fail that drug test, and then I'm not going to be eligible to be returned to my job. That's a lesser form of blocking. I hope that answers Justice's question.
Mr. Rohde, I've got a question, and maybe you can answer this, maybe you can't. I'm a little concerned about the time frame. If you've got a situation where you've got a positive drug test, as Burso had here, how long does it take before that license is no longer valid? Is there a month period, a three-month period? Does it happen automatically? What's the time frame here?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, Justice Crooks. What's the time frame on how long use of drugs would destroy your eligibility to return?
He's got a commercial driver's license, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now you've got a positive drug test. The positive drug test affects his eligibility to continue to have a valid commercial driver's license.
Okay.
Does that happen automatically? Does it take 6 months or 3 months, or what's the time frame?
I understand your question now, Justice Crooks. I can't tell you the exact time frame, but I know what this is it's a federal motor safety carrier regulation issue. And I'm certainly by no means, unfortunately, not an expert on that. But there is a procedure by which someone who fails a drug test and thus is their employer required to take them off the road, there is a process under those federal motor carrier safety regulations by which someone can basically rehabilitate themselves. I know the next step is they have to take a new test and test clean before they regain their eligibility. So it is possible, but I'm sorry, I can't tell you the time frame. I would suspect, just from a little bit I know about, I'm a criminal defense lawyer largely up in rural Wisconsin, and I know that marijuana, for example, stays in your system a lot longer than other drugs. It's detectable for typically 30 days.
Does the statute or the regulation, based on the statute, tell the employer you must take this employee off the road?
Yes, the federal regulation, it's 49 CFR, I believe it's section 40.23. It's cited in my brief. It requires employers of truck drivers who test positive to remove them from the road.
So the trucking company here really has no choice. You got a positive drug test. That's it. You cannot drive for us.
Right. Until whatever steps must be followed, there is a process by which they can regain their CDL, but it does take some time.
Thank you.
Let me shift gears for a moment and talk about the other statute. We've talked about misconduct quite a bit. The other branch of my brief is the 108.04 sub 1 and sub 2 arguments about whether the person is able to work or available to work. That is an issue that we've banged the drum every time at every level that this case has been heard, and it's been heard many times, as you see from the procedural history. It was noticed at the very first hearing before the administrative law judge. There was testimony on that issue that was elicited by the administrative law judge, and there were questions answered by the employer about the fact that he did not have other work that was available that did not require a CDL. So all of those issues were explored, but for some reason, the ALJ didn't address them in her decision. LIRC did not address this issue in its decision. When I got involved at the circuit court level on judicial review, unfortunately, Judge Kowalski chose to take a pass on that issue. And the first time that issue was acknowledged by any courts was by the Court of Appeals. And then, unfortunately, they got it wrong. And I have to take a little bit of credit because even I myself, in my petition for review, I acknowledge made a mistake. I had to really comb through the record and find that there was, in fact, testimony way back at the administrative law judge level about that issue. And so I think that is at play here as well. The ability to work and the availability to work under 108.04 sub 1B1 and sub 2. And I think the most important case that I think deals with that is the Reed decision cited in my brief. It's a 1997 decision. A bus driver that tested positive for cocaine use. He was discharged, but then given a second chance to try and get into good graces and regain his job. Then he was bumped by an employee with more seniority, and by the way, he was bumped indefinitely off work, but then called back and tested positive a second time for cocaine. So he was terminated at that point. And what's key about Reed is that LIRC decision decided that case on 108.04 sub 1, sub B, sub 1, availability and unability. It specifically held that employee, Mr. Reed, had by his own actions rendered himself unable and unavailable to work. And so they used that basis. Now, my opponent wishes to focus on the statute is really a cumbersome statute, by the way. I think I said 9 pages of fine print, and then there's administrative code that interprets it further. And my opponent is certainly an expert on unemployment law working for the division that he does. But I don't think it's right, his argument, where he wants to focus on just being physically or psychologically unable to work or unavailable to work. And because, most notably, the Reed case doesn't mention those criteria, whether he's physically or psychologically available.
Counsel, I'd like to talk about 108.04.1F.
Yes.
It provides that if an employee is required by law to have a license issued by a government agency to perform his or her customary work for an employer, and the employee's employment is suspended or terminated because the license has been suspended, revoked, or not renewed because of the employee's fault. Sounds like it covers this case, right?
I know this is not an error-correcting court so much to speak as it is creating important law kind of court. But yes, Justice, and that issue
and
was...
The rest of it says the employee is not eligible to receive benefits until 5 weeks have elapsed. So they seem to be eligible, but you lose out on 5 weeks, if I'm reading this right. You laid out the text in your opening brief, and you talk about it a little in your reply brief. And LIRC doesn't cite it at all, if I read the brief
right.
Correctly. So it seemed to me this is arguably applicable and just renders the employee ineligible for a short time.
I agree. Most of the statutes, when they say they're unavailable or ineligible for benefits, have a certain time period.
Right.
It's very and you're right, Chief Justice. It certainly would have been a valid argument upon which any one of the tribunals that heard this case along the way could have, I think, ruled in favor of the employer in this case. But for some reason, none of them seized on it, despite, once I got involved, my invitation asking them to do so.
So then you would only be out, you would be saved 5 weeks of unemployment comp, right?
Well,
if that was applicable.
If that's what the statute says, I don't know if I cited the part that you read the rest of it, but if that's what the law says, then I agree.
I think I read it correctly, but
I would trust
possible
you.
There's a misstatement here.
Well, I trust
but,
you.
But if 1F applies, you save 5 weeks or whatever number.
That's what the statute says, then they would have been ineligible for benefits for at least 5 weeks under that particular statute, yes.
Well, if you lose on your first argument, you like this argument, you're only out on 5 weeks?
Well, of course, you could do whatever you want in this case.
No, I think the court should do what the law requires it to do.
Absolutely, absolutely, Chief Justice. But that would be the net effect. If you chose to base this decision on that statute, I think that is correct, Chief Justice.
You know, as a matter of policy, on the one hand, you got an employee who does something on his own time and doesn't know if he's going to be called back or not. He does something on his own time. And why should he be punished for doing something on his own time? He doesn't have to follow the employer's rules. On the other hand, you've got the company who needs a licensed driver and doesn't have a licensed driver in this employee. And to make it even more significant in terms of the employer's interest and the public interest, the employee is doing something illegal. So you got a balance here of two public interests.
That's the conundrum I refer to, Justice.
That's the conundrum.
Yes, I agree.
Your suggested solution is the employee's conduct barring him from the license terminates unemployment comp.
Any misconduct that destroys eligibility to return to the job, I think, should be a separate category. I don't think that all misconduct that you might get away with in the context of when you're an active employee necessarily should disqualify someone who's on an indefinite layoff, but some conduct on an indefinite layoff that destroys eligibility, I think.
Maybe a middle ground is 108.041F.
That would be a middle ground for this particular circumstance, but I think it can be broader than that because I don't know that we have to limit it to just that issue. I see my red light is on. Does that mean I'm supposed to stop?
That means you're supposed to stop, but you can come back after Mrs. Sample is done. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Counsel. William S. Sample, Attorney Sample, representing the Labor and Industry Review Commission. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is William Sherlin Sample. I'm on staff at the State of Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission, and that's the institution I represent in these proceedings. Madam Chief Justice, Madam Justices, may it please the court. The issue in this case is how far the unemployment insurance law, as it stood in 2009, reaches toward Mr. Barrasso's conduct that took place when he was not an employee of Waldvogel Trucking. As we all now know, this is not a case of first impression, it's a case of last impression because of the legislature's recent enactment of 108.048B. We do not believe it is a case of misconduct because when Mr. Barrasso engaged in the conduct in question, there was no employment for that conduct to be connected with. It is not a disqualification under 108.041B1 because of termination due to unavailability for work, because both the wording of the statute and the case law make clear that the unavailability that is disqualifying under that statute is not the unavailability for the specific work performed for the employer. It is general unavailability on the general labor market. Finally, we don't believe it's a case of general unavailability either because the administrative code lists the criteria pursuant to which a finding of unavailability is to be made, and Mr. Brousseau does not meet those criteria. We also do not believe it is a case of license suspension under 108.041F, because while Mr. Brousseau could not engage in commercial driving with his license, the license itself was not suspended, revoked, or non-renewed due to his fault.
What happens? I looked at the regulations that were cited, and so the employer has the obligation to report this right away. They don't have any if, and, or but under the federal rules. Well, then what happens? So they report it, and then is the shoe on the driver's foot to try to get somehow the report set aside or remove the prohibition on his driving or what?
The shoe is on the driver's foot to remove the prohibition.
Okay.
The prohibition is against performing any work for which the CDL is required until the employee goes through the three steps that any employee in Brousseau's circumstance has to go through. They have to meet with a substance abuse professional. They have to follow the substance abuse professional's treatment recommendations, and then they have to return a negative drug test. But the inability to perform work requiring a CDL is the only consequence to an employee in Brousseau's circumstances. The license is not suspended. It is not, and it is not revoked.
It's just not usable until
he gets
rehabilitated or whatever.
It's just not usable for commercial truck driving work. And as to the suggestion that 108.041F applies, we believe this would be an expansion of the terms of the statute. And in the seminal case, Boynton Cab, this court said that we are going to construe punitive provisions narrowly because they are not the purpose of the unemployment insurance law. So we would suggest that it would be inappropriate, given the nature of the unemployment insurance law, to read the three categories, suspension, revocation, and non-renewal, to cover this instance.
So your position is he's got a license, but he doesn't have a license. He's got a license, looks good on paper, it's not suspended, not revoked, and it's not up for renewal, but he can't drive anyway, right?
He can't drive using that license. He can do any driving work that does not require a CDL.
And the employer here said they don't have a job for him. Without a license, right? Without being able to drive with a license.
So Brousseau meets the first part of the 108.041B1 test.
There's no job.
His employment was terminated because he was unavailable to do the work the employer had for him. But that is not what is disqualifying under 1B1. What is disqualifying is the second notion of unavailability, and that's general unavailability. The statute states specifically, if an employee is terminated by the employee's employer due to the employee's unavailable for work otherwise available with the employee's employer, then the employee is ineligible for benefits while the employee is unavailable for work. It doesn't say unavailable for his or her work or unavailable for the work that he or she was terminated from. The first mention of unavailability in the statute is what gets to the work the employee did for the employer. The disqualification only occurs with the second mention of unavailability, and that is general availability or unavailability in this case. Availability on the general labor market.
So he's available on the general labor market, is that right?
Although the Court of Appeals is the only entity that actually made a finding on that issue, looking at the criteria, We say yes, because he does not meet any of the Wisconsin Administrative Code DWD 128.014 criteria for unavailability for work. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, he is able to do any driving work for which a CDL is not required, and he is also available to perform any other work that he knows how to do.
In order to be available under those general circumstances, though, doesn't he have to be applying for so many jobs a week?
Yes, he does. Those are other conditions, and as to the best of my knowledge, there has not been an issue raised by the department as to his not doing the things that every unemployment insurance claimant has to do. Look for jobs, keep track of the jobs you look for.
What if he were working for this company, he weren't on layoff, and he were working in, you know, just as a matter of practice, he comes in on a Thursday for a drug test and he fails it. So they fire him. Is that misconduct connected with his employment?
If he is an employee of the company and he has a positive drug test for misconduct, that is a positive drug test, yes, that's misconduct. And we have consistently held that to be the case when the evidence establishes that the underlying act from the drug test, which is the ingestion of the unauthorized controlled substance, took place after the beginning of the employment relationship. We have consistently held that when the conduct in question took place before either the existence of an employment relationship or before an offer of work, then those acts are not disqualifying because there's nothing connected to them. And that the crimp, that we have a case, the Perry case, that is analogous to this case. And in that case, we distinguish the same circumstances that are present here from what happened in Crimp. We have regularly found that once an employee has an offer of work, if they do something that results in them losing that offer of work, they have blocked it. But before that offer of work comes into existence, there's nothing for them to have blocked by their conduct.
Well, wasn't he receiving unemployment compensation based on payments made into the account by Wallbogle Trucking?
If you have
someone working for you, you have to make unemployment compensation payments while they're... So some of the money he's getting was money paid into the account by Wallbogle, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so he's getting that money, but... All right, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that there's a window here that nothing applies, the rules don't apply.
An unemployment insurance claimant is eligible for benefits unless a specific statutory provision disqualifies the claimant, and we see none in this case.
Counsel, I was listening carefully to your distinction between this and the Crimp matter, and I'm looking at the summary that's in one of the appendices of Crimp, and I see that it tells us in pertinent part that Crimp had been indefinitely laid off on August 31 of 01. That on October 30 of 01, he receives a letter from the employer, and this is what the summary says, asking if he was interested in returning to work. Okay, so he gets a letter asking if he's interested in returning to work. He gets that on October 30, and apparently the same day, he calls and is instructed to report to the office the next day to get the address of a clinic for a pre-recall drug screen, you know, which he obviously, as you know, attends the next day and is found to have very high levels of alcohol in his system. But this, from this summary anyway, it does not appear that the offer had actually been made, that you're hired, now you need to do the alcohol screen. Is that the distinction between Crimp in this case?
Once the employee reports, he had not been hired, but he had been given an offer of work. They offered him a recall subject to the drug test. So he now has notice of the recall. After notice of the recall, what does he do? He drinks excessively, and the result of his drinking after the notice of recall is the loss of the...
Is that in the record somewhere other than this summary that it is in one of the appendices?
The crimp decision is pages 122 through 124 of my appendix.
But so that would be the distinction.
That would be a more accurate. You know, our summaries are generally accurate, but obviously they're not the actual decisions themselves.
And that's printed on here, and that's why I'm asking, because that does seem to be the great distinction to be drawn, which is in Kremp, it was post-offer conduct,
exactly,
according to your argument, post-offer conduct, which blocks the employers, which constitutes misconduct.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It was not misconduct. It was the post offer conduct resulted in a failure to accept work in Kremp.
Okay.
Kremp was not a misconduct decision, but the same the situations are analogous. Once an employment relationship has begun, then an employee's conduct can be disqualifying if it's misconduct. But before it begins, it can't. We think that 1B1 already governs this situation, unfortunately, for Wallvogel Trucking. They ask for a new provision to cover this situation that's unique. We don't know how unique it is that someone is laid off and potentially available to be recalled to their employer, because that happens all the time. But the statutes, 10804, 1B1, specifically addresses exactly this situation. An employee cannot perform the work. He's not ineligible for benefits because of that. He's ineligible only if he's not generally available for work. I'd like to discuss the teacher-lawyer examples. We don't think they're exactly apropos, as stated. It would be closer if the teacher were someone with a license to teach developmentally disabled children, and the lawyer were, say, for example, licensed to do guardian ad litem work. If during their respective layoffs, for whatever reasons, they lost their developmentally disabled teaching license and GAL license, but still were eligible to be teachers, to be a teacher and a lawyer, that to us is what is going on in this case. Rousseau lost the ability to perform work requiring a CDL. He did not lose the ability or the availability for any driving work that did not require a CDL or any non-driving work.
Mr. Sample, what deference, if any, do you feel is due to Lurk in this case?
We think our decision should get great weight deference from reviewing courts.
And why do you think that's the case?
We disagree with the Court of Appeals in Cudahy, where they gave us only due weight deference on the ground that our decisions in the area of drug testing were inconsistent. I hope I made an argument in my brief that our decisions are not inconsistent. You know, the legislature empowered the DWD and the commission to administer the unemployment insurance statute. That legislative prerogative is a reason for deference. We handle a lot of cases. The last time we were before this court in an unemployment insurance case was in May of 2000. Since that time, we have issued 31,110 unemployment insurance decisions. Do these numbers make us better able than the courts to determine the proper outcome in a given unemployment insurance case? No. Do the numbers make us more knowledgeable than the courts of the unemployment insurance program as a whole, a program that is nuanced, detailed, and intertwined with federal law? They're supposed to. That's the point of the existence of an administrative agency such as the Commission. And the deference standards recognize this. The due weight deference standard applies when the agency has not yet developed the expertise that would place it in a better position than a court to make judgments regarding the interpretation of a statute. This factor thus expressly contemplates that there are going to be areas where the agency has developed that expertise. Now, this expertise occasionally does not appear, but that is rare, very rare. On the vast majority of occasions when we have exercised our expertise and experience and specialized knowledge, there's nothing inappropriate about this court deferring to a reasonable interpretation of a law that the legislature has charged the agency with administering. And the law is not just Chapter 108. There are state administrative code provisions accompanying the law, along with interpretive directives from the Department of Workforce Development. There's FUTA, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. There's provisions in the Social Security Act. There are accompanying federal regulations to those statutes. There are accompanying interpretive directives on those statutes and regulations from the Department of Labor. There are all kinds of factors that go into a decision. We have a lot of experience in dealing with them, and we think it's, assuming the decision is reasonable, it should be entitled to great weight deference.
Counselor, should we ascribe any difference between this case where what the employee did not only resulted in his suspension, or well, it wasn't really a suspension, his inability to use his commercial driver's license because what he did was an illegal act, marijuana use is against the law, as compared with someone who had his license made unusable because he just drank a ton, where alcohol ingestion is not against the law? Should we make any distinction between those two circumstances?
I think we should not.
Why?
Because the unemployment insurance law is not a criminal law, and it is not a moral law. It is a set of conditions, and that is all it is. If a claimant meets the conditions for eligibility, such as having the requisite amount of wages in the claimant's base period, then, and the claimant also does not meet any of the disqualifying provisions, such as a discharge for misconduct or a quit for no good reason, then the claimant is eligible for unemployment insurance.
Counsel, I would like to come back to the Krem matter. I've now had the opportunity, and I do have the decision in order before me. And it is, as you said, at page 122 of your appendix. Well, I appreciated the assist before. My eye is struck by that ambiguous phrase again on the first page of the decision in order that says, in late October, the employer sent Mr. Krem a letter inquiring whether he was interested in returning to work and then giving him a deadline of November 5 to contact the company. To my eye, inquiring if someone is interested in returning to work is different from offering work. And then I go to page 2, At the bottom, the last paragraph, the analysis in this case hinges on Wisconsin Statute Section 108.048A, which disqualifies an employee from immediate eligibility for unemployment insurance who fails without good cause to accept suitable work when offered, period. When an employee engages in conduct which prevents an employer from offering work or which causes the employer to withdraw an offer of work, the claimant is guilty of blocking the job offer. And so, therefore, I'm not clear in light of that more specific language where they do seem, that decision and order seem to contemplate a situation where the conduct blocks even the offer of a return to work.
The offer from the employer was not the letter asking if the employee were interested in returning to work. After the employee received that letter, he telephoned the employer, said he was interested in returning to work, and at that point, the employer said, return to work tomorrow morning, and we'll give you the address of the laboratory where you have to go take your drug test.
All right, but how does that square with the language in regard to when an employee engages in conduct which prevents an employer from offering work, or?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
The question is, how is the holding in Kremp in that decision in order, how is that not applicable to the facts of this case?
I see. The offer of work in Kremp occurred before Kremp engaged in the conduct in question. See, the employer told Kremp to come to work tomorrow.
Well, but how?
and then after he has this notice, this offer, then he engages in stupid conduct.
But you have some language in Kremp to deal with which seems at odds with that analysis, where the beginning of the last sentence on page 2, which begins in the middle of that last line, when an employee engages in conduct which prevents an employer from offering work.
Okay?
That seems to be a little bit at odds with the analysis that you're presenting here today in regard to the facts of this case. That's what I'm having a little bit of difficulty with.
I still think the requirement here is that the offering of the work has to take place before the conduct in question.
You can see why, by the language in Kremp,
yes.
I might be having trouble agreeing
yes.
with you. Okay.
You make an argument about compliance with the federal FUTA, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, and that your interpretation would be consistent with that act, and a contrary interpretation may jeopardize some benefits. Can you further elucidate on that?
I can. My yellow light is already on, though.
That's right. You have a problem when it goes red. You then have to ask permission to continue.
The Federal Unemployment Tax Act contains certain statutory criteria that every state must follow if they want the employers in the state to receive the 90% credit against the payroll tax that employers pay. This is what is called conformity. We took Waldvogel to be asking this court to find that an action by a claimant outside of any employment relationship be categorized as misconduct. And that would violate one of the federal standards that is a conformity standard. That standard is in 26 U.S.C. 3304 A10. And it allows what's known as the cancellation of wage credits in only three instances: discharge for misconduct connected with work, fraud in the filing of a claim, or three, disqualifying income. The latter two are not applicable. The notion of cancellation of wage credits can be seen by looking at the misconduct penalty. In addition to the requalification requirements under 108.045, the wages in the employee's base period from the misconduct employer are thrown out, and so they cannot be used to determine the claimant's eligibility for benefits. That's called cancellation of the wage credits, and it can only be done for three reasons, and none of those reasons are finding that somebody engaged in misconduct outside of an employment relationship.
Thank you.
The Reed case, if I may, was a case where the employee had a positive drug test. He first was discharged by the employer. They converted the discharge to a suspension. This was in week 36 of, I believe, 1999. A 96. However, it was not an indefinite, he was never indefinitely laid off from his employment with Reed. The employer and Reed both contemplated a 90-day suspension period, following which Reed was going to be returning to the work he previously had done, work requiring a CDL. In the interim, he was eligible for certain non-safety sensitive work, and he did take one of those assignments, and he was laid off from that. But that had no effect on the fact that his employment relationship continued with the employer during the 90 days that the parties contemplated he would take before returning to his work. Then in week 44 of 96, when he was getting set to return to his previous job, he had a second positive drug test. At this point, the employer discharged him. The commission's actual ruling in Reed was that he had been suspended under 108.041B1, but the commission did not make a finding on misconduct, because that had not been noticed for hearing. The commission remanded the case to the department in order for the department to issue a decision on the week 44 separation. And that was the point I was trying to make in my brief, however badly. The reason that case could have been remanded for a determination as to the separation in week 44 was because the suspension in Reed was of definite duration. Employment relationship continued. Therefore, Reed's actions during the definite suspension could be grounds for misconduct.
Now your red light is on.
Now my red
light
is on.
You should
May
complete.
I wrap up?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Quickly.
An unemployment insurance claimant is eligible for benefits unless a specific statutory provision disqualifies the claimant, and there was no such provision in the law as it stood in 2009. Waldvogel begins with the conclusion that Berceau should be ineligible for unemployment insurance and does not care how the court gets there. Waldvogel agrees with the proposition that actions occurring prior to the existence of an employment are not connected to the employment but asks for an exception. That would be to legislate, and this court has noted the inappropriateness of its so doing. Walvogel says it should be the rule that employees who use illegal drugs that destroy job eligibility cannot receive unemployment benefits and asks this court to so declare. That would be to legislate as well, and it would be doubly inappropriate here because it would be to legislate on an issue that the legislature itself just legislated. I hope I've addressed the issues of concern to the court today. If the court has no more questions of me, I thank the court for its attention, its courtesy, and above all, its patience.
Could I ask one question?
Justice Prosser.
Was Mr. Berceau paid on August 12th, 2009?
I do not believe the record has any. The record does not indicate whether he was or not. I would think that an unusual circumstance if he had been. I didn't get paid my first day at work.
Well, was he not an employee from August 12th through August 18th?
He was an employee from August 12th through August 18th. He was, yes.
And wasn't he paid for that period?
Oh, I could only speculate, Your Honor. I don't know. The record does not say anything about what remuneration he did or did not receive for that 6-day period.
What would the significance of remuneration be?
I don't think it would have any significance. I don't know what the significance would be.
Well, there's reference to a pre-employment test, isn't there?
Yes.
But it was a test apparently taken when he was employed.
The notion pre-employment test is fairly loose, and I don't know that you can say that the pre-employment test necessarily occurred before the employment began. It could have been before the employment began. It could have been at the beginning of the employment. It could have been a couple of hours after the beginning of the employment. Every one of those instances has been called a pre-employment test.
What is its significance if it is really before employment began? Employment began at noon, the test was at 9. What's the significance of that?
I don't know.
There was no marijuana shown at that time. I mean, that it was. He didn't use marijuana at 9 o'clock when he appeared for the
test. That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
I think there's nothing in the record to indicate when the marijuana use took place. I think that's my recollection.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sample.
Thank you.
Mr. Brody?
I'm going to talk fast, but not too fast.
Right. We don't get it. It's not worth making it.
Right. I'll try and go in reverse order. I agree with the last dialogue. There is no way of knowing when the marijuana was used in this case, if it was before or after the recall. We don't know. With regard to Justice Prosser's question, I have to echo my opponent's sentiment. In the record, it is not clear. I do not know the answer to whether he is paid. I could speculate, but that would not be appropriate. With regard to the issue before that, regarding there was some comment on deferring to the role of the legislature here. The legislature has given us the broad general rule that misconduct connected with employment disqualifies someone from receiving unemployment benefits, and they have given some specific instances of what constitutes misconduct. But I would suggest that it is the appropriate role both of the courts and the administrative agencies that interpret the statute to define what specifically might constitute misconduct. I don't think that's invading the province of the legislature. In fact, I think it would be impossible for the legislature to define every single possible thing that could be characterized as misconduct. And finally, I would point out on that point that it was the courts who have given us the indefinite layoff rule, which is the subject of much debate here today, not the legislature. So certainly the courts play an important role in interpreting and applying these statutes.
Legislature hasn't changed the court's interpretation until 2011.
I don't know that the legislature changed the court's interpretation.
In 2011, but at least that's the movement.
Okay. With regard to Justice Bradley's question on the federal tax credit, the FUTA issue, I think that's an excellent question. My comment on that would be, as my opponent concedes, the federal law certainly does allow the states to define what constitutes misconduct connected with work. Therefore, if this court would enunciate the rule we're asking it to and define misconduct that is engaged in during an indefinite layoff period, which destroys eligibility to return to the job as misconduct connected with work, I think we would no longer have a problem with that concern about the federal law. And furthermore, even if we did, I would suggest that the legislature then has already overstepped its bounds on the federal law, because 108.04 sub 8 sub B now regulates what my opponent is apparently warning against, and that's delving into what they consider pre-employment issues. That now allows an employer to declare, the system to declare a failed drug test as a declining an offer of employment. So I don't think we have any problems with the federal tax credit issue. There was a question on the standard of review. I think that was either Justice Crooks or Justice Rogensack asked that question. It is our position that the highest deference that should be given is due deference, but I can make a great pitch for why no deference or de novo deference is appropriate in this case. I would start with, it's cited in my brief, the Brownice decision that Justice Crooks wrote in 2000 for the general proposition that reviewing courts are not bound by LIRC's statutory interpretations and may consider whether the circumstances of each case warrants deference to LIRC's interpretation, and more specifically, the DeBoer decision that Justice Rogensack wrote just last year, wherein this court held an administrative agency's interpretation and application of a statute is afforded no deference and is reviewed de novo when one of two situations applies. Either we have an issue that is one of first impression, or when the agency's position on an issue has been so inconsistent as to provide no real guidance. And I believe both of those apply. The application of the indefinite layoff rule from A.O. Smith to cases where the misconduct destroys eligibility to return is an issue of first impression that this court is considering. And as far as being inconsistent, the Patrick Cudahy decision from 2006 has already declared, and I quote, LIRC has been inconsistent regarding use of drugs in or outside the workplace and whether such use constitutes misconduct justifying termination. So I think for very good reason this court can declare that it's a de novo review in this matter. Couple of other points. The Perry decision was cited, and again, I think the distinguishing factor, and this gets into the Kremp arguments, on Perry, what is a significant difference is, in Perry, that employee had no advance knowledge or notice that a failed drug test would lead to the loss of her eligibility to be reemployed. I think that is a significant difference that exists in Reed, in Edwards, and in Mr. Berceau's case, and the Kremp case. All of those cases, the employee was charged with advance knowledge before they engaged in the substance use. that it could have a negative impact on their ability to return. Justice Gableman found the Crump decision, and I thank my opponent for including that in his appendix, so that issue is taken care of. And I guess maybe I'll just close with this thought. Despite the creation of this new statute in 2011, I'll restate again, I think it is very important and imperative for this court to issue a substantive ruling or decision on this case that is consistent with and complements and further clarifies and defines that new statute. And so I think it's entirely appropriate for a decision. I see my
red
light.
Want us to clarify the new statute?
Well, clarify that the exception rule that I'm asking for would actually be consistent with or complement the new statute. It would be a better way of phrasing it, Chief Justice. I'm sorry.
So you want us to interpret the new statute to make it consistent with the rule of law you want the court to do?
If this court enunciates the rule that I have advocated for, it could properly characterize that as complementing or being consistent with the statute. And I think case law that's consistent with the statute is not only good, but, again, that situation I described where I dropped the ball.
Do you interpret the new statute as changing the existing law, or do you interpret the new statute as codifying what is the existing law?
The new statute, 10804 sub 8 sub B, is an offshoot of sub A. Sub A just basically says that a failure to accept a work offer is grounds for denial of unemployment benefits. B, 10804 sub 8 sub B, now defined one particular type of conduct using drugs as a form of failing to accept employment. I hope that answers your question.
Well, it wasn't there before. So when the legislature enacts a new statute, sometimes it codifies existing case law, or maybe it codifies an administrative regulation. Other times, it inserts something that's not there that they think that should be there. So if that's true, then you use the new law to say, well, it wasn't ever in existence before and we're not going to make it retroactive. And nobody here is asking to make it retroactive. So I was just curious as to what your view is on that.
I agree with all of your positions, and I cannot argue with any of them, and I don't know which one of those it is, and I can't offer any more intelligent comment other than that, I'm afraid.
I've stated the problem and no solution to it, so thank you, Counsel. Are there any further questions? Justice Protzer.
Mr. Brusseau was brought back on August 12, 2009. He took a drug test the next day. Is that right?
It was within a week. I know that I think the test may have been done on the 18th, or maybe notice was of the failed test came back to the employer on the 18th, and then he was let go on the 19th.
I think I read in here it was taken on the 13th of August. I thought I heard you say earlier in the argument that marijuana can stay in the bloodstream, can be detected in the bloodstream for maybe close to a month afterwards.
I believe from my own personal experience that is correct, and perhaps sometimes longer.
As an advocate.
Really personal?
As an advocate.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that clarification, Justice Bradley.
We'll strike that from the record.
From my own personal experience as a criminal defense attorney and dealing with marijuana possession. Thank you. I believe that's the case, but that's not of record. But I think that's pretty commonly accepted in science. But your question?
Well, suppose Mr. Brusseau had been brought back on August 12th and they hadn't taken the test for 2 weeks and it turned up positive. Would it have been the employer's obligation to prove exactly when marijuana was used and to preclude it from being before he came, before August 12th?
I don't think so. I think it makes it more egregious when it is done after they know for sure they're back to work. But I think even if it was, as the reason of the indefinite layoff rule, even if the guy never knew he might ever get called back, if he went and used it anyway, it still disqualifies him from returning to the job, and he knew that in advance that it would, and so I think it still eliminates him from eligibility, but it would be more egregious if it were after the recall. I hope that answers your question.
Well, it might be more egregious, yes, but this might all hinge on a failure of proof. How do you prove when someone had marijuana?
I don't know how you can. I believe it is a substance that stays in the system for some time, and I agree with my opponent's position that he's taken, that there's no way of knowing when Mr. Burso used the marijuana in this case.
But do you take the... Was this case presented on the theory that he used it before he took the employment and before he took the test?
I think most of us have made that assumption, but we don't know for sure.
That's right. But the assumption is that you don't get to misconduct on indefinite layoff unless you assume here that he took the ingested marijuana when he was laid off. Otherwise, you got the argument of misconduct while employed, right?
Right, or the other situation of if there was no job, if he wasn't laid off, it was totally pre-job, that's very different than being on an indefinite layoff.
That's right. So the assumption, as I read the briefs, was that it was indefinite layoff, and during that time period, he ingested marijuana. Now the problem is, what did he do? Is that misconduct? Because it was not done while on the job.
Correct. That is the question. Clearly, if it was done while on the job, it'd be a different situation.
Different case.
And I'm advocating, again, that when it's done with the knowledge that you might return to work and that will destroy your eligibility to do that job that you might be recalled to, then it should be deemed misconduct.
Hearing no other questions, I want to thank you, Mr. Rohde, and you, Mr. Sample, for your interesting briefs and arguments on unemployment compensation. We get more workers' comp than we get unemployment compensation
thank you.
Here.
Thank you all.
And that ends our argument on 11AP329FT, Michael J. Waldvogel Trucking versus Labor and Industry Review Commission. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will continue oral arguments. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:25.